I want to welcome everybody here, and I'm going to call on Eric Cohen from Holocaust Education Week just to say a few words, and we'll get started.
Good evening. My name is, as Jay said, Eric Cohen. I'm a volunteer on the Holocaust Education Week Committee.
How's that?
I'll start again. Good evening. My name is Eric Cohen. I'm a volunteer on the Holocaust Education Week Committee. On behalf of the Sarah and Chaim Neuberger Holocaust Education Center, I welcome you to this evening's event. First, I'd like to thank the host organization, Torah in Motion, for their support. I would also like to acknowledge and thank Congregation B'nai Torah for their co-sponsorship of the program. We are especially grateful to our lead sponsors, Apotex Foundation, Honey and Barry Sherman, and Elizabeth and Tony Comper. We are proud to have CTV as our television media sponsor and the National Post as our print and digital media sponsor. This is the 31st year of Holocaust Education Week. In commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the trial of Adolf Eichmann, our central theme this year was accountability. Multidisciplinary programs reflected upon the dramatic historical events of the trial and its implications for accountability in today's world. We would appreciate your feedback on the events you've attended. Audience feedback cards are available on the table outside in the foyer. You can also visit our website, www.holocausteducationweek.com. We further invite you to visit the Holocaust Center at 4600 Bathurst Street and follow our progress in building the new Sarah and Chaim Neuberger Holocaust Education Center on the redeveloped Sherman campus. In order to bring you the highest caliber of programming, your financial support is vital, and we thank you for your generosity. You can make a tax-receivable donation through our website or by phone. I now would like to ask you kindly to turn off your cell phones and pagers. I hope you will find this event to be thought-provoking and informative. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not going to turn off my phone just yet because my notes are on it. My name is Dov Altman, and I'm the CEO of the Canadian Friends of Bar-Ilan University. And I just wanted to say thank you to all of you for attending tonight, and thank you to Torah in Motion. I think that Toronto is a very unique community and a very lucky community to have such an organization like Torah in Motion, which really brings Judaism alive to our residents and to the people here in Toronto. And we've been fortunate over the years to be able to work with Torah in Motion in showcasing some of Israel's best. And Bar-Ilan's best and brightest have had an opportunity to speak to the Toronto community because of Torah in Motion. So, Rabbi Kelman, thank you very much. And to all of you in Torah in Motion, kol hakavod. I'd also like to mention that we're honored tonight to have our Member of Parliament, Mark Adler, with us. Mark is the only member of the parliament whose parents were actual survivors of the Shoah. And we're honored to have you with us and look forward to working with you in the future. What I really wanted to do is introduce our speaker. And before I do, I'm just going to take 2 seconds to say I just got back from Israel. And, you know, here it is, Holocaust Education Week. And what a remarkable thing it was for me to be in Israel last week and then to think about what we're talking about the Shoah and what it did to us as a people, but how we've overcome and how we've come back. I was blessed to be in Israel last week to be part of the opening ceremonies for Israel's 5th medical school, the Bar-Ilan Faculty of Medicine, which we built in Sfat. We decided to build a medical school. Israel needed one, and we built it in Sfat because we needed to raise and elevate the level of care for Israel's northern region. It's pure Zionism 101. We're developing the north to make the north more secure and to build a stronger Israel. And how remarkable it was to see that happening within our state. But what was even more remarkable is to see the kids that we were able to bring back, 54 students who had to leave Israel to study outside because there wasn't space, were able to come back to Israel, as well as 15 scientists have returned to Israel. Two of them, I must say, are responsible for the Sarah and Chaim Neuberger family, who have generously sponsored two of those scientists. So it really is an incredible thing for me to see that growth and to be a part of it. And I know that the Toronto Jewish community has been strong supporters all along, and for that we're forever grateful. Professor Timmy Kaplan, teaches modern Jewish history at the Israel and Golda Kashitsky Department of Jewish History at Bar-Ilan University. His field of scholarly interest is religious history in the 19th and 20th century, with a special focus on popular religion, and his topics of research include sermons, sermonic literature, religious denominations, American Jewry in the 19th and 20th century, and Haredi society in the 20th century. Again, a good, strong Toronto connection that the Kashitskys and Golda Kashitsky, Zichron Levracha, endowed the Department of Jewish History. It's my pleasure to introduce one of Bar-Ilan's best and brightest, Professor Izzy Kaplan, Kimmy Kaplan.
Good evening. Thank you very much. I'm very happy that you have coffee and something to eat. We have a lot of details to deal with this evening. After knowing about this annual most impressive Holocaust Education Week for some years and learning about Torah in Motion, it is my honor to be here. I owe this honor to Professor Eliot Malamet and Rabbi Jay Kelman, as well as my deepest gratitude for their patience, kindness, and warm welcoming. And a special thank you to the Emerson family for their generous hospitality. Thanking is the fun and easy part, and I allow myself to keep it short since we have several tasks to accomplish in 1 hour, or a bit less. We'll see how we go. To be sure, our topic this evening can easily sustain an annual academic course, and therefore the only promise I will surely fulfill is not to cover it in full and thoroughly. Before setting forth the main issues that demand attention, please keep in mind the following three clarifications. The first one, unlike many Israelis, I'm willing to admit that English is not my mother tongue. So please bear with me. This is an opportunity to thank Stanley Emerson yet again for saving me from a few inaccuracies in the previous version of the paper. Second point. As we all know, anything to do with the Holocaust and studying it critically is extremely sensitive. Our cumulative knowledge of the horrific, cruel, unimaginable, and inconceivable events that took place cast a very thick mist on any attempt to try and document and analyze any aspect of the Holocaust in a balanced manner with a view to looking into issues, events, and processes through the eyes of those who were there at the time. The responses and actions of religious leaders, which are going to be at the center of our discussion this evening, are no exception. In my humble opinion, scholars, this is the third point, scholars should not be out to judge what they study, but rather document, contextualize, analyze, and consequently supply knowledge and tools for discussion and evaluation. I therefore have no intention of offering any kind of judgment, especially not one that is value-added in any way. Overall, there is no shortage of knowledge regarding the responses to and actions of leading religious figures during the Holocaust and after the war ended. Therefore, I will try to focus on a few rather well-known figures and touch upon the period following the war as well, so that we can see certain dimensions of Torah in Motion's past week's theme, accountability. Any fair discussion regarding religious leaders who either left, escaped, fled Europe, I'll get back to that in a minute, or decided to stay, even though they could have done otherwise, must be considered within various wider contexts. First and foremost, terminologically speaking, left, escaped, rescued, and fled are not identical terms. And choosing any one of them over the other suggests a covert, if not overt, judgment. But we have no choice, otherwise we cannot converse. So don't catch me by the word. I just, whatever I choose is without many options, or else I couldn't be here. Secondly, there is a big difference between a practical decision and a theoretical deliberation. Naturally, when the option to leave becomes practical, there are many additional considerations to take into account. We will focus on cases in which leaving was indeed a practical option. Furthermore, balancing is crucial. For every rabbi or Hasidic leader who decided to leave, escape, flee, There are many others who decided to stay while having the option to leave. Since we will focus for the most part on those who left, allow me to mention one example, that of Rabbi Menachem Zemba of Warsaw. Construction of the Warsaw Ghetto ended in mid-November 1940, and this overcrowded area, as well as additional constraints and hardships, led to a significant rise in the numbers of those who died in the following months. In January 1941, 898 people died in the ghetto. In June, the number reached 4,290, and in August, 5,560 people. Starting May 1942, the Jews of Warsaw were subject to several rounds of expulsions and deportations, totaling in the tens of thousands. For example, during the 10 days beginning July 22, 1942, around 65,000 people were deported. After another round in January 1943 ended, it was clear that the bulk of Warsaw's Jews have been deported. And we then enter the final stage of this ghetto and the uprising, namely April into May of 1943. At this point in time, there were almost no Orthodox Jews left in Warsaw, and Rabbi Zemba had very few followers, if at all. During this last period of the ghetto, a passport of a Central American country was organized for Zemba, but he refused to make use of it and died in the midst of the uprising. Interestingly, not longer after the war, actually before the war ended and after the war ended, an internal Haredi debate began regarding Zemba's support, or some argued disapproval, of the uprising. The sources from within Warsaw, as well as evidence of people who took part in the uprising, such as Israel Gutman, renowned scholar of the Holocaust, who was part of the uprising in Warsaw Ghetto, all noted Zemba's support of the uprising. But Haredi writers, such as Rabbi Simcha Elberg, argued that this is impossible, since it contradicts basic Orthodox and Haredi values, such as the sacredness of life and the fact that in this situation an uprising was equal to suicide, a forbidden act according to Jewish law as interpreted by Orthodoxy. This is one example of the dynamics of accountability in post-war Haredi literature. I must emphasize, Zemba clearly supported, but the issue of accountability, of trying to post-war deal with it, is sometimes tougher than reality, and people could not face it, and we'll hit a few more of these examples. Another wider context relates to the fact that responses, dilemmas, and actions regarding leaving or staying were not unique to religious leadership. Israel Sassover, rather known as Menachem Begin, Beitar's commissioner in Poland, left bombed Warsaw on September 5, 1939, and after several hardships, arrived at Vilna, then the capital of independent Lithuania, following the Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement. Following a careful study of Begin's speeches and actions starting 1944, Yechiam Weitz argues that Begin carried strong feelings of guilt over his escape for years. Indeed, as we shall see, the considerations for and against staying naturally had a religious side to them among religious leaders. Nevertheless, the basic dilemma is arguably similar. To be sure, the decision to hide, an attempt to escape involved many considerations for any individual who considered this option, such as adopting Christian identity, leaving one's community, friends and family, and daily hardships that resulted from doing so. Last but not least, we must keep in mind the historical context. Leaving Germany in 1938, before or after Kristallnacht, is one thing. Leaving Poland in 1940 is another. Leaving Vilna between October 39 and June 1940, prior to Vilna's occupation by the Red Army and its declaration as the capital of Soviet Lithuania, is a whole different story. And the same can be said for leaving Vilna between June 1940 and the German invasion to Lithuania in April 41. And finally, leaving Hungary in March 1944 is a different case altogether. Avoiding the specific context is unjust and inevitably leads to wrong analysis and conclusions, let alone false accusations. Furthermore, in many cases, the circumstances are the crucial issue. At times, the dilemmas are similar, but as we shall see, the circumstances make the whole difference. If you wish, dilemmas relate to options, and options relate to the situation, and these change from sometimes minute to minute. It is worth re-emphasizing at this point that the heated moral debate regarding religious leaders who left their flock is many times far from accurate due to overlooking the specific circumstances. Now you might know the story about the monks who are sitting in the monastery and debating if Jesus existed or never existed. And after 3 days of exchanging arguments, they go to the father of the monastery, and each side sets down his arguments. And the father thinks for a minute and he says, it doesn't matter if Jesus existed or didn't exist. The important thing is that the Jews killed him. So at some point, the actual reality or the facts lose their meaning. But I think that in such a topic as this, and life has its own rhythm, and the facts don't really play much of a game in that rhythm. It's rather how we interpret the facts, which is more the issue. But we cannot disregard them. If we disregard them, we're basically, I think, leaving any ground of trying to analyze and see differences and similarities in the way people decided to do one or the other. Please keep these points in mind as we go back into our time tunnel and travel back in time with a view to taking a close look at a few cases, some of which are rather well known, but nevertheless include dimensions, I dare argue, and angles that have not been fully accounted for. Nazi officials and rank-and-file SNS soldiers and commanders enjoyed demeaning Jewish traditional and religious symbols and institutions, such as synagogues and cemeteries, Jewish, if you wish, appearances, beards — they love to cut off beards for the fun — and personalities associated with them, rabbis, religious leaders, and the like. Therefore, religious leaders were many a time especially persecuted and searched for. Nevertheless, Nazi anti-Semitism, and this is very important, I'll explain in a minute why, was not religiously motivated, but rather racially. This distinction has numerous significant legal religious implications which demand separate attention, such as the very basic relevance of rules pertaining to religious persecution as interpreted by Orthodox rabbis to this situation. In simple words, and I'm going to use a little bit of Hebrew terms, so excuse me, it is a halachic basic term. Is the Holocaust defined in halachic legal terms as what is considered sh'at hashmad, a time of religious persecution? If it is, it has numerous implications of what the individual should or not, or should not be doing. In contrast, if it is not religious persecution, it has implications the other direction, in the sense that the individual is obliged to do almost everything in order to stay alive. Now, clearly, racial anti-Semitism is not religious anti-Semitism. And this is, I won't open the topic beyond what I'm saying now, but if you give it some thought, it raises many, many questions about the way we understand. And again, I'm not trying to judge. This is very important. It's a very sensitive issue. I'm not trying to judge in any way. But if we're trying to understand people who said, I fasted on Yom Kippur, or I did not eat chametz over Pesach, even though the circumstances were could have been endangering my life, if it is not religious persecution, the question is that the right act to do or not? Again, I'm not judging it. It's an emotional issue. It has a lot of, we have a lot to discuss about this, but it's a very important point when discussing what goes on in real time and what comes up later in various literature. Be it as it may, religious leaders were targets, and one such case was Rabbi Avraham Mordechai Alter, leader of the Gur Hasidic court, the biggest Hasidic court in Poland. The Nazis were on the lookout for Alter in late 1939, early 1940, after invading Poland. As a result, he changed his name, and on January 20th, 1940, Adam Cherniakov, head of the Judenrat in Warsaw Ghetto, succeeded to sustain Alter's forged identity when accompanying Alter himself to a meeting at the SS offices in Warsaw. It was clear that Alter was on the Nazi target, and later evidence suggests that his image was one of significance in German official eyes. For example, in 1941, after Alter was already out of their reach, the Nazis published a photo of him entitled "The Ostjuden as Seen in Marienbad." Marienbad was a resort where people used to go and vacate, a summer resort. This photo was part of an exhibition entitled "The Eternal Jew." Another photo of him, together with a few other Hasidic leaders, appeared in the famous Nazi Der Stürmer. So, he's not an unknown person. Be it as it may, a small convoy was formed consisting of Alter and a number of people close to him after an escape plan had been set and Alter had appointed a replacement. In April 1940, they left from the Praha train station in Warsaw and traveled for just over 2 weeks through Krakow, Vienna and Trieste, and then got on a boat which brought them to Palestine. At this point, it is important to keep in mind the importance of a Hasidic leader to his flock. He is not merely a halachic decisor or a preacher. He is regarded as someone blessed with supernatural qualities and an address for advice and assistance on a daily basis. The potential absence of such a central figure makes his decision to leave much harder. Alter, who already buried a few relatives who died in the massive bombings of Warsaw, left behind most of his family, including his wife and most of his children, all of whom he never saw again. This convoy reached the land of Israel, Palestine, and Alter led the local Gur community for the next close to 8 years until his death during the 1948 war. Starting the mid-1920s, Alter encouraged his followers to resettle in Palestine, and during the late 1920s and 1930s, Gur established a strong community in the heart of Tel Aviv, intentionally in Tel Aviv and not in Jerusalem, because he did not want to deal with Jerusalem's zealots, Kanaim. Many members of this community were active in this city's urban economy during the Mandate period. In addition, other communities were established in Jerusalem and other locations. It is important to emphasize that Alter's dilemma, or for this matter, that of Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, leader of Chabad, who also left Warsaw in 1940, was not one that we can define as Holocaust-related, assuming we associate Holocaust with mass killing of Jews and subsequently a final solution for them. We are talking about the first months of the war, during which the Nazi regime was focused on conquering countries and establishing its rule. Given Hitler's approach to Jews and Judaism, the Nuremberg Laws, Kristallnacht, and other public anti-Jewish expressions and actions, the recent Blitzkrieg in Poland was clearly no good news for the Jews. But Alter, or anyone else for this matter, had no clue or reason to speculate later destructive developments. To be more accurate, they did not have any reason to assume that women and children will be killed, and thought that the focus is and will remain on central leading figures. Even though Alter could not have foreseen the future, he was devastated upon discovering that most of his family and many of his followers were killed. During the 3 years after the war ended, Alter met with survivors of his court and reportedly sat and cried with them. Alter, he didn't say a word about the Holocaust. He just sat and cried. Alter, as well as his son and successor, Israel Alter, remained silent in theological terms regarding the Holocaust. To be sure, silence can be interpreted on the one hand as a theological statement, in line with post-biblical commentary of Aharon's silence upon the death of his two children. But on the other hand, it can result from an understanding that there are no sufficient theological explanations that can cope with an event of this magnitude. For various reasons, it seems as though, in this case, the latter is more likely. But either way, this, I submit, is an expression of accountability. Due to aforementioned circumstances, Alter's case is relatively easy, in commas, an easy one to account for. As we move along in chronological order, things will get by far complicated and consequently controversial. The next rather well-known case is that of the yeshivas which fled from Russia to Vilna following the Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement. It is impossible to go into all the stages and specifics of this episode, and for our purposes it is important to emphasize one crucial point. For those who were in Vilna and those who fled there, this seemed a relatively safe haven, certainly until the Soviets returned to Vilna and to a degree later as well. Given the knowledge they had regarding the war and Germany's strategy, which led its army further away from Vilna, this was a reasonable assessment of the situation. For years, several Zionist and religious Zionist activists and leaders accused the leaders of the yeshivas who assembled in Vilna of refusing to accept Zionist certificates and escape to Palestine while it was feasible due to their anti-Zionist ideology. But later evidence, such as Zerach Verhaftig's memoirs, who was at the time a messenger to Vilna, and years later a prominent member of Israeli parliament and minister, suggests that this was precisely their reasoning, not ideological or theological, but rather an assessment of the winds of war. In response to his proposal, Verhaftig recalls that most heads of yeshivas told him that the Germans will get to here, the Russians to here, and we will be safe in the midst. Once again, similar to Alter, they could not have foreseen the fate of Lithuanian Jews starting mid-1941, tens of thousands of whom were shot and buried in the thick woods that characterized Lithuania's rural landscape. Notwithstanding these feelings of relative safety, there were those few who had doubts. One such well-known person was Rabbi Finkel of the Mir Yeshiva, who wrote as follows. I'm quoting, "We are in a situation whose outcome we cannot know. Our rights to stay in the country can change at a moment's notice, and we can suddenly be forced to leave and wander wherever the wind takes us. And the terrible thing is that the whole world is closed to us, and it is such a bitter storm that is now sweeping Europe. For now, we are permitted to remain with the yeshiva in Kedan, in Lithuania, but we are considered prisoners in jail. And even if it can be imagined that our right to stay here will continue for a long time, no one in the yeshiva can predict the future. For how can any prisoner in jail fathom how he will manage in life?" Finkel did not leave his fears up in the air and acted with a view to finding ways to leave Europe with his students. Curaçao was an option, and later Kobe, Japan, with the help of the famous Japanese consul in Kovna, Sampo Sugihara. But unlike many other cases in which people did not seek permission from the authorities to leave, assuming they will not get it, in this case, requests for immigration were presented to the NKVD, the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs, the public and secret police organization of the Soviet Union. Allow me to pause for a few seconds in order to emphasize that escaping without formal permission classifies those who do so as unlawful citizens. Deciding to go this route includes numerous dilemmas in and of themselves: hiding, escaping the authorities, cheating, disclosing friends in order to survive, etc. A host of these dilemmas are irrelevant when one immigrates legally. Now back to our case. In hindsight, this attempt to leave Europe with permission succeeded for the most part. But at the time, feelings were rather different, as the following record alludes from 1940. The mood in the yeshiva was extremely depressed. The requests for exit permits were going to be submitted this time not to a Lithuanian office under Soviet supervision, but to the NKVD. And who knew what faults would be found during the NKVD interrogation of the applicants? It would be superfluous to stress how carefully the leaders of the yeshiva handled this matter. When the decision of the Mir students to submit the applications for exit permits became known to the other yeshivot, it made a terrible impression. They, meaning the other yeshivot, truly feared that this request would bring utter devastation upon all the Torah scholars and hasten the end of the yeshivot. Another related dilemma in real time relates to compiling lists of people based upon the assumption that not everyone who wishes to leave will be able to do so. In this case, the religious leadership, including Rabbi Aaron Kotler, who after relocating to the United States founded the Lakewood Yeshiva, adopted the following guidelines that appear in Tractate Horayot of the Babylonian Talmud. A man has precedence over a woman, a priest has precedence over a Levite over an Israelite, Israelite over a bastard, but if the bastard, and so I'm jumping as I'm reading the Mishnah, but if the bastard is a scholar and the high priest ignorant, the bastard has precedence over the ignorant high priest, and so forth. In accordance with these guidelines, the leaders decided upon a list, which included numbers, in other words, an order that determined precedence. This process was described at the time as follows. We did everything very seriously and very calmly in accordance with the instructions of the Rashei Metivta. The students were each given a specific ordinal number by the representative of their yeshiva, according to their importance and the necessity of their leaving there. The sum total of those on the list of all the yeshivot and the list of the refugee rabbis and their families is more than 1,500. We decided, and I'm skipping here, that every general list of permits which would be drawn up by us would include an exact proportion of each and every yeshiva according to the numbers of its students. Small concessions were made only vis-a-vis the rabbis and their families. We discussed every single detail very seriously, and we did everything with the approval of all the members of the committee. Due to various developments, this plan did not materialize in full, but it nevertheless sets forth the most overt legal framework to deal with dilemmas of whom to rescue and at whose potential expense. Furthermore, in this case, there is no dilemma of should I go or should I stay, but rather who should go before whom. Ladies and gentlemen, there is no doubt a strong moral dilemma, and one which has been severely criticized by scholars and Holocaust survivors and rigorously defended by Orthodox rabbis and spokespersons. Without entering into this value-laden argument, I dare propose that we place this heated debate within a wider context of what we can term as quality rescue. In other words, now I'm not judging the quality, I'm trying to give it a terminology, okay? In other words, the mission of saving those who are considered leaders, personalities who have the capability, authority, and charisma that are needed in order to pass along tradition to the next generation. These people are perceived important, and their qualities outweigh other quantitative scales. Put it simply, it is more important to save one such person rather than a host of rank-and-file Jews. Now, you should know that in Israel we are accustomed to an annual circus on this topic in the days before or after Holocaust Remembrance Day. Some radio or TV program will confront a Haredi representative, such as Israel Eichler of the Bell's Hasidic group and Professor Dina Porat of Tel Aviv University, and within less than a minute, we will have the best show in town. They are each at the other's throat on the issue of leading Hasidic rabbis who fled Europe, leaving their flock behind, and quality versus quantity. But in this heated debate, one important fact is overlooked. which is, almost every Jewish stream or group which was ideologically motivated acted with a view to saving quality rather than quantity. This was the case with Beitar, Menachem Begin, the Shomer HaTzair, and the Reform and Conservative movements. To the point, in the case of the Reform, that there was a preference at the latter part of the war to save artifacts over regular human beings. Once again, keeping in mind that quality rescue rather than quantity was not unique to the Orthodox camp, provides a wider and more balanced context to this sensitive topic. As we proceed into the years of the war and the planned gathering of Jews in ghettos and camps and their organized mass killing, the dilemmas are more complex, primarily since there is more knowledge, or even if only feelings and scarce evidence, about what is going on. To be sure, there is no information from the German authorities, and furthermore, as David Bankier has demonstrated, whenever speaking about the Jewish problem and solution, Hitler consciously used vague and misleading terms, unlike any other topic in which he was rather clear. Nevertheless, survivors and pieces of evidence were floating around, at times outside Europe more so than within the areas under Nazi rule and those engaged in battle. But it sounds so far-fetched and consequently hard to believe and therefore doubtful. Deborah Liebstadt, I think she was here. I don't know if she spoke about this, but she wrote a whole book about the American press during the Second World War relating to the Holocaust. And the finding, which is, her most striking finding, which is the most tragic one, is that the more information came and the more reliable the information, the less reluctant were the editors of the main newspapers to publish it, because it sounded crazy. And the editor of the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever it is, who gets information about masses of people killed and says, if I'm going to put that on the title of my first page and the next day this becomes unreliable or it's refuted, I've lost my... I may have lost my job, but the newspaper has lost its credibility. So they solved the dilemma by putting information on page 13 or 14 or 15 in a small thing, so someone picks it up, it's not a title, whatever. The same, by the way, happens in the Yishuv in Palestine. I'll give a Haredi example. Moshe Prager, who left Warsaw with the Rabbi Alter of Gur, he was a Hasid of Gur, he was a journalist and an author, he came to the land of Israel, and his first job was writing in the Davar newspaper of the workers of Palestine on European issues. And after the Warsaw ghetto uprising, he, similar to many others, said, this can't be, this story is, something here is wrong. It doesn't make any sense. How could a few hundred Jews create a whole battle for 3 weeks in the ghetto of Warsaw against the German army? Makes no sense. So someone blew up some story or got some piece of knowledge and blew it up and it went out of proportion. And Prager felt bad for years and years afterwards, saying, how could I have not believed at that time that this is the real story? And that's the tragedy. The tragedy is the story is we can't deal with it. And therefore, it's so doubtful in real time. Keeping this in mind, we have two cases to address. That of Rabbi Aaron Rokach, leader of the Belz Hasidic Court, and that of Yoel Teitelbaum, leader of the Satmar Hasidic Court. In 1940, 60-year-old Rokach had tens of thousands of followers in Galicia and Poland. And shortly after the war began, Belz was under Soviet ruling following the Ribbentrop-Molotov agreement. With the support of some of his followers, who perceived the communist anti-religious regime as very dangerous for religious leaders in particular, Rokach and his brother, Mordechai of Bilgurei, left for smaller towns in rural Galicia in Poland, through which they wandered for over a year. During the Barbarossa operation, Germany conquered East Poland, and Rokach, at the time in Przemyślan, was smuggled to the area of Krakow. The summer months of 1942 were especially fatal, as we all know, for Polish Jewry in general, who were sent en masse to well-known death camps, and by the way, no less cruel and fateful less-known camps such as Janowska in Galicia, and for the Jews of Krakow in particular. Krakow's ghetto experienced several deportations starting May 1942. Rokach and his brother were smuggled again, this time to the Bochnia ghetto, and after a while yet again to Budapest in the car of a Polish officer. Notably, the money for this ongoing endeavor came from Jews situated in the free parts of the world. Towards the end of 1943, Zionist certificates were secured for Rokach and his brother and authorized by the British authorities in Palestine. Rokach received a Polish passport and left Budapest on January 17, 1944, and arrived at Haifa port on February 2nd, after traveling through Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Istanbul, Haleb, and Beirut. Yonah Cohen, at the time a Zionist representative in Haleb, describes Rokach vividly and sensitively as a person with dimmed eyes and emotionally worn out, if not broken, a point to which I will return in a moment, since it has to do with accountability. Rokach's case may not have been drawn so much attention, if not for the fact that on January 16, 1944, a day before leaving Budapest, Rokach's brother delivered a sermon, the main message of which was, quote, "quiet and calmness for Polish Jews." In later years, this sermon was subject to several editing attempts by Bel's Hasidim, who wished to omit this ultimately tragic statement of their leader. But the text was not only uncovered in full, but Mendel Piekarz, a scholar who studied Hasidic groups and Hasidic theology, discovered and published a strong text of the Rebbetzin of Stropkov, who related sarcastically to Rokach's statement, during her period in Auschwitz prior to her death, where she basically said, "Where are we and where is your statement about Polish Jewry?" Unlike previous cases, this is one in which the person who is the center of the story, as well as those surrounding him and acting with a view to getting him out of Europe safely, sensed, if not knew, much more regarding the deportations and mass killing of Polish Jewry starting mid-1942. Therefore, the dilemma is by far stronger, both on the side of those who acted to rescue Rokach, as well as those who supported this effort from without, given that they could have utilized the funds required in order to try and rescue Jews from other areas with initial higher rates of success. As mentioned, by the time Rokach arrived in Palestine, he was a shadow of himself. This is not surprising, considering the endless experiences, adventures, dangers, and uncertainties that he encountered for close to 4 years. At this point, the story, according to Bell's historiography, is of a hero who rose against all odds to the challenge and revitalized and rebuilt the Bell's Hasidic court in the heart of Tel Aviv, adjacent to several other Hasidic courts, which somewhat symbolically, ironically, were situated on Ahad Ha'am Street. However, historical evidence suggests that this court recovered not due to, but rather notwithstanding Rokach. Upon discovering his personal familial loss during the Holocaust and the fate of many of his followers, Rokach's mental state deteriorated considerably. He sat for days in his room, at times entered the central prayer hall, and after a few minutes left back to his room. And most striking is evidence according to which he cherished the annual Memorial Day, Yahrzeit, of his relatives who did not die during the Holocaust and did not do so regarding those who died during the Holocaust. I dare suggest that he was not in state that he could metaphorically face the results of the Holocaust and his decision. While we can debate the possible explanations for Rokach's behavior, it seems quite clear that the Bel's Hasidic court renewed itself in absence of its leader rather than due to his presence. At times, accountability can have destructive results. Last but not least, a few words on the famous case of Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, leader of the Satmar Hasidic court. Teitelbaum's mother presumably said about her son that, quote, if he were to be alone in the woods, he would quarrel with the trees. Now, if she were a Polish mother, on the one hand, or a German Yekish mother, on the other hand, we could safely disregard this statement. But she was Hungarian. In addition, more substantiated evidence regarding Teitelbaum reassures that we are facing a rather controversial person. For one of several examples, in 1928, he was chosen to serve as Satmar's rabbi, but assumed his position only in 1934, since the community was divided over his choice. In the midst of these 6 years, Teitelbaum developed a tense relationship with Rabbi Aharon Roth, who led an extreme Hasidic sect, later known as Toldot Aharon, before their recent split into two groups in Jerusalem. Situated in Hungary, Teitelbaum, like many other hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews during most of the war, was relatively marginally affected by the Nazi regime and mass destruction of European Jewry. As time went by, Hitler's forces were facing problems and several painful losses in the battlefields since the winter of 1942, and it seemed as though the worst was behind them. But in March 1944, as we know, the Nazis entered Hungary and within 4 or 5 months sent the bulk of Hungarian Jews directly to the gas chambers in Auschwitz. By the way, contrary to our perception of bureaucratic German efficiency and rigorous documentation, many of them were killed without any listings. Upon seeing the war clouds over Hungary and receiving various information, Teitelbaum and a few others close to him decided to escape Hungary without notice and did so overnight in a Red Cross automobile, a day or two prior to the Nazi invasion. Unlike Rokach, Teitelbaum gave no farewell sermon, explanation, or words of comfort for his thousands of followers. Due to our time constraints, I will not go into all the stages of his escape from Europe. The automobile was stopped close to the Romanian border, and its passengers were sent to the Cluj ghetto and from there to Budapest. Subsequently, Teitelbaum was among the 1,685 passengers who boarded the famous Kastner train in the night between June 30th and July 1st of 1944. This train's destination was Spain, but when it arrived at the Hungarian-Austrian border, it halted for 2 or 3 days until Eichmann ordered that it change route and proceed to Bergen-Belsen, where it arrived on July 8th. With 1,684 passengers, as one died on the way. After a month with preferred treatment in a separate area within Bergen-Belsen, 318 passengers continued to Switzerland, and the rest did so in early December 1944. Teitelbaum was in Switzerland from December 7, 1944, until August 20, 1945, the day he began his journey to Palestine, arriving at Haifa's port on September 2nd. After a year in Jerusalem, by the way, it's interesting. After arriving in Haifa the same day, he made his way to Jerusalem. His first stop in Jerusalem was the Western Wall, the Kotel HaMaravi. It's the same Western Wall that after 1967, Teitelbaum ordered his Hasidim not to go near because it was released by Zionist forces. That's the irony of history, I guess. After a year in Jerusalem, during which he was rather marginal in the local extreme Haredi scene, just to make a point, Teitelbaum had a little synagogue in a street called Shari Pina in Jerusalem, And there were many Shabbatot where he did not have a minyan. Teitelbaum relocated to New York and began, this is summer 45, relocated to New York and began to set up his court almost from scratch. Over the years, he led to the establishment of a big and wealthy Hasidic court, as we all know. This well-known and controversial case has various less-known aspects, and one of them has to do with accountability. In 1956, Teitelbaum was approached to give evidence on behalf of Israel Kastner, who was on trial in Israel, famous trial of Kastner. Kastner was accused, and after being assassinated, he was acquitted by the Supreme Court of Israel. Teitelbaum refused to give evidence in favor of Kastner. And in a hidden paragraph in one of his books, he goes further to explain that Kastner was a criminal, since he is responsible for the death of thousands of Jews in Hungary, and he, Teitelbaum, will not support such a criminal. Out of all the aforementioned cases, this specific part of Teitelbaum's story I admittedly find hard to explain from a personal point of view, since I would assume that a person who owes his life to someone would remain silent even if he does not think much of his Savior, let alone attack him. But this may be my personal disposition. It can be debatable. Interestingly, this attitude toward Kastner has various expressions within Satmar's internal historiography. For example, naming the Kastner train the Bergen-Belsen train, and arguing that Teitelbaum got on the train notwithstanding Kastner's opposition. An argument which is factually wrong, and I'll explain why. Israel Kastner did one thing very meticulously. He set up a committee which will decide who will get on the train. He did not decide anything by himself. And he did so purposefully so that, if you wish, for the record of history. And there was one guiding rule to the way that committee worked. And that was that the Kastner train is, if you wish, a Noah's Ark. And that Noah's Ark has to have representatives of all the animals. Namely, having Jews from all different groups representing everyone. So that no one will say that he put his friends or his family at the expense of others. Now, this committee took the decisions. It wasn't Kastner's personal decision. And therefore, and from what we know about the dynamics of that committee, and we do know, one of the members of that committee, I think, is still alive. He's very old. He lives in Israel. He's over 90, as you can imagine. I hope he's still alive. We have documentation no shortage of. The conscious attempt to create a balancing of those who got on the train, including, by the way, rich and poor, not only issues of representative of different groups or subgroups within Jewish society, one of the rules of the committee was that those rich people who are on the train are going to pay extra so that those who cannot afford will be able to get on the train. So there was a serious attempt to create a balancing at that moment. So therefore saying that Teitelbaum got on the train notwithstanding Kastner is somewhat unfounded, again, factually. Allow me a few words of summary. This rather complicated picture is partial and moreover might lead to the conclusion that it is impossible to draw a general picture with some common threads. I do not agree and contend that we can suggest a few preliminary conclusions. First and foremost, any attempt to detach the historical context, both general and specific to each case, from the dilemma, should I leave or should I stay, will almost inevitably lead to wrong conclusions and judgments. Furthermore, anyone who argues that any one of these leaders, known or could have foreseen what would happen, I dare think, say, suggest is unfounded. They did not know. What they knew at times was partial. There was misleading information. They could not have known. They could not have foreseen the future. In any one of these cases, there were feelings, there were senses, there were suspicions. No one could put their finger and say, I know. There was one person who did so, but it was, again, these voices, when we read them backward, then they have more meaning. Abba Kovner, in 1941, got up and said, friends, the Germans are going to kill us all. After he heard what was going on in Russia with the Einsatzgruppen, who were killing Jews en masse, he said, the Germans are out to kill us all. And this is what it's going to be. But at that time, there were people, Jews, in many other parts of Europe, who, again, could not identify with that or could not fully understand what was going on, did not fully know. So the idea that there is some, and anyone who argues that there is some divine knowledge of the future, in this case, I don't think it works. Maybe in others it does. I can't say. Okay. If we would arrive at wrong conclusions or judgments, again, in the critical historical sense as well as the moral one. And my point is clear, that in order to really try and deal with the moral dilemmas that people had, we cannot do without the historical context. Thus, the moral dilemma doesn't make any sense. The whole moral dilemma is based upon the specific reality that any given person was faced at any given moment. Secondly, notwithstanding the significant differences and numerous nuances, certain basic themes and morally related aspects reappear in many of the cases, such as quality rescue. Thirdly, the triumph-like tone prevalent in Orthodox Hasidic historiography, which projects the events and dilemmas through the lenses of post-war revival of Hasidic courts, avoids the complexities, the dilemmas, and the decisions taken at the time, and in many ways avoids any discussion regarding accountability. Finally, extreme circumstances can lead to extreme responses and actions, and therefore it is virtually impossible to criticize and judge them in a balanced manner. Thank you for your time and patience. Open for.
Are there any questions? We'll take one or two questions if anybody has.
That's fine. Now, I just have one request. This is a cultural difference. I come from Israel. In Israel, people are not as polite as you are, A. And B, the first thing they do is criticize. In North America and Canada, it's very hard to figure out the criticism because people are so polite and so thankful. Please be Israeli for a few minutes. If it's criticism, lay it out.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sam Shapiro. I'm a survivor. I really, really enjoyed, Doctor, the way you put it, really the way it was. Because I was there, and I witnessed exactly what you tried to give us, your message. I'd just like to explain along the line, as you put it, what had happened in 1942 when the German occupation have announced that the Jews have to go to camps. My mother and father went to the rabbi because, as we all know, in Poland, all the Jews were Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox. and nothing was done. And our Polish religion, that we did not consult the rabbi, may it be whatever happened. We went to the rabbi, and I guess most of the Jews in our city near Lublin, and his answer was, it's God's will, God will help and protect us, you gotta go. My question, and what bothered me, burned in me all my life till now, is why? Why wasn't the leadership of the rabbinical to organize, and because it was known for 5 years previously, the German Jews came to Poland, to our cities, and told us what was going on. And I'm sure the rabbis were aware. Why did we not take arms to protect? As a lot of us did do that, my family escaped to the forest, joined the underground. For 300, six survived by the Polish murders. If our rabbis would have helped and brought and educate us and tell us to take up arms or defend ourselves, hundreds of thousands would have survived. I believe, and I can say now, thank God that the Israelis defended themselves, and even against the British army, therefore we have Israel today, a state that can be all proud of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
What can I say?
Be an Israeli.
I served in the army, that's all I can say. 20 odd years or more.
I understand your reluctance to pass judgment. I can't pass judgment, but I know that I'm going to share a personal vignette, a very short one. My father was born in Satmar, and he was maybe an 18-year-old boy. And to this very day, he resents the fact that the Satmar Rebbe abandoned his community. And he uses the terminology that he basically abandoned ship. Forget about the whole question about what he did after in terms of his resentment of the Zionist movement, the very people who saved him. I think there's a distinction between people who perhaps lead a movement, who are maybe of a secular movement, the religious, the Beitar movement, for example, and a Hasidic movement where the people are so tied to the leadership and to whatever they say. And if I recall correctly, my father would say that the Satmar Rebbe said, don't worry, you know, these winds of war will pass. I find that very problematic, and I'm curious as to what you think about that.
Okay. You're forcing me into the corner. That's fair. It's okay. First, regarding the Satmar Rebbe, there's one important piece of information, which I, again, one of the things I couldn't go into, but it is interesting. It's instructive. The common knowledge, which you'll find in many history books for time and again, is that in earlier stages, when people could escape, and came to ask him if to leave Hungary or not, his and primarily to leave to Palestine, because that was the prevalent option from Hungary for sure, his answer was categorically no, because he was anti-Zionist. That's wrong. We have evidence of survivors who went to him, evidence given already after the war. Find them in Yad Vashem, several pieces of evidence that the survivors gave, in which they account that they or family members went to him and ask if they can leave. And when it was families, he said, yes, go. And when it was individuals, he said no. Because he said family is a unit. A unit can sustain itself even though it's going to a unfriendly religious zone or anti-religious zone, whatever you want to call it. An individual cannot. So he's more in danger than the family as a unit. That's just, by the way, to make the balancing within the balancing of did his anti-Zionist clear opinions, and he had them already by then for several years, did they completely overcast the option of in the situation of allowing people to go? The answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. But back to your point. The only thing I can say, which I still feel that I cannot take a personal side because of the complexity. I admit, it's my weakness, if you wish. And I fully understand the strength of your comment as well as the person who spoke, Mr. Shapiro, right, who spoke before you from his personal encounter. I do think that the only thing that we have to keep in mind is that if you're in Hungary in 1942-43, the war is all around you, but it's not in Hungary. And in that situation, which again, we know today that it was deceiving, but at the time, at real time, given Germany's losses, starting in Russia and then North Africa and so forth, one after the other, as time is going by, it makes the consideration of the possibility that the worst is behind us, Germany will never get to here because it's losing, it's lost the game, it's reasonable. It ended up to be wrong, but it's a reasonable calculation. And at that point, I can understand where he will say, friends, you'll be safe here, don't worry about it. That doesn't solve the issue of leaving overnight. It doesn't, no question. But until the beginning of March 1944, that is a perfectly reasonable assessment of the situation. It's tough beyond measure to try and get back into the logic and the thinking of a person in the real time because we know the results. I'll give you another example on purpose. I'm floating to a different area altogether. In 1938, late 1938, after Kristallnacht, a bunch of rabbis in Germany write a letter to Hitler, a direct letter. Now, this sounds insane, but it sounds insane to us because we know. They write a letter to Hitler, and they say to him, we are German citizens. This is a country of law and order. And what's going on here in the streets is a mess. You know, we're persecuted, we're ridiculed, whatever, and we're asking you, I mean, we're assuming, you know, law and order is law and order, we're asking you to put your foot down and trickle down to the system that this cannot go on. You cannot run a country without law and order. And this has to stop. Now, we look at it and we say, where are you living? Right? That's the immediate response. Where are you? You don't know who you're dealing with. You don't know what's going on. You didn't see synagogues burning and windows and shops broken and whatever, broken into. Where are you? The answer is, it takes a lot of time to translate something like that into something much further than what it is. It feels like a bad wind. It comes, it goes. And the ruler is a ruler. And these are people who are in Germany for decades, if not generations. All right? Again, prior to Germany as being the Reich, prior to 1871 or after that. And they're used to a certain... It takes a lot to take you out of that, to put you in a new position and say, the world that you knew is finished. You're in a new world. And I can completely understand. Again, it's tragic, but I can completely understand where someone... That's what it takes, and he doesn't move. And only after Kristallnacht, we know of, at the last moment, as far as Germany is concerned specifically, tens of thousands of Jews fled Germany, primarily to the U.S. Because they came to the conclusion that things are really bad. This is not, in commas, the usual. We're in something different. But it's still a feeling. They don't have more than a feeling. They have an experience that they have. It's a traumatic experience. I'm not going to take that away. But they have... they don't have anything. There's no sense of anything else going on. They don't. There's no plan. There's no voice of mass killing of Jews or anything. This is not an issue. No one fathoms this, or no one has reason to fathom this at that point. So that's why I'm trying, in a sense, if you wish, to defend. All right, if that's the word, the Satmar Rebbe's statement again until March 44, which I can understand politically reading the map. What he did, it's not so much the act of leaving. My sense is how the act was done. The fact that it's overnight without anyone knowing, again, aside from a few people who are involved in the case, it's in the escape itself, it's very different than the Belz Rebbe who gets up and says, I'm leaving and I'm giving a sermon to whoever will come and listen to me and say what I have to say, as wrong as it might be, again, consequently or subsequently. It's a different ballgame. I really don't know how to deal with it. But the last thing I'll say is, and that's something that I'm not trying to draw any comparison. But I can tell you this from my little experience, but I'm sure that anyone here could have had an experience similar in a different situation in life. I think it's a crucial point in the personal sense. In very extreme situations, human beings act differently than they do in extreme or hard or whatever other situations. You see that time and again, if you serve in any army and you're in combat, you see it all the time. There's a certain point, and it's completely subjective. It's completely it's subjective to the person, to the situation, to how he reads the situation, where it's as if a switch turns on or turns off, and you act completely differently than you would have acted otherwise. Because you feel that you're under danger, or immediate danger to your life, and at that point, things change. They can change either way. It's unpredictable. You can say, I surrender. You can say, I'm going to fight it to the end. Anything can happen. But it's a sense of an extreme situation which demands an extreme response that you would not have done otherwise. And as I'm not comparing army service to what we're talking about. No way. But what I'm saying is that I think that we have to be fair to the extreme circumstances in order to understand that all the possible extreme responses or actions could take place by any given person, including leaders, assuming they are human beings.
Last question. Yes, I wonder why the Haredim still revere the important rabbis when they could not foresee or even warn them of the greatest disaster that would befall the Jewish people. And I'm talking in particular of the Chofetz Chaim, who died in 1933, the year that Hitler rose to power. He didn't warn the Jews, let alone foresee this Holocaust that would happen. Yet the Chofetz Chaim is so revered today as a demigod.
I think he died in 35. Not that it matters much.
Yes.
It's prior to any, you know.
Okay, but it was said.
I agree. I can't answer. There's one thing I can say, and that is that, again, the way the Haredi mind works, I'm saying in general, but I think it can be proven with I don't know how many hundreds of quotations, is that history is read anachronistically. We read backwards. So what we do is, we take a statement that Chafetz Chaim or someone else made in 1910 or 1920 or 1850 for whatever it matters, and only after the events We can reread that statement and apply it to later events. That means when he said that things in Europe will be very, very bad, whoever said it, okay, at any given time, we didn't understand him for decades. Only after, long after he died, and only then the Holocaust came, now we understand what he really meant. So it's a certain, in a sense, it's a circle, it's a closed circle, by which the minute you assume that leading figures, leading religious figures, have this supernatural power or ability to foresee the future, it doesn't mean you will understand it in real time. It may take decades until you figure out what he meant. And again, this is a circle that either you're in it or you're out of it. You can, if you believe in it, you believe in it. It doesn't matter what Kimmy Kaplan will say or anyone else will say. If you don't believe in it, it also doesn't matter. Because this is the sense. I'll give you an example, not from the Holocaust. I had a friend, high school friend, who served in, like myself, in the first Lebanon War in 1982. Both of us were in tank units, and he was very severely injured and flown with a helicopter to Rambam Hospital in Haifa and treated in an intensive care unit. He was treated for a few days, and after a few days, the doctor said, "We've done all we can. We can't do more than that. Now it's wait and see, or pray, or whatever you wish. We can, medically, we've done all we can." A member of that family was close to the Vizhnitz Rebbe who was in Haifa. There were two of them. There was one in Bnei Brak and one in Haifa. He was close to the one in Haifa. He went to him to get some blessing, advice, support, whatever. And the Vizhnitz Rebbe in Haifa said to him the following. I'm almost quoting word by word. He said, he went to him on Monday. On Tuesday, things will get worse, and so on Wednesday, and so on Thursday, and so on Friday, and so on Saturday. And on Sunday, there'll be big relief. So it happened. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, things got worse. On Sunday, he passed away. Now, I'm saying this, again, as an outsider, right, I'm saying he missed it out. But any Hasidic, any Vizhnitz Hasid who I told this story to said to me, that's what he meant by relief. The family is going to be relieved from this awful situation of having a person who cannot function by himself to stay alive. It's a real relief that he, you know, passed away. So it's an issue of interpretation. And this is very, it's hard to argue. Again, I'm not to prove or to argue. It's, are you in the circle or are you out of the circle? If you're in it, you're in it. If you're out of it, you're out of it. And that's why I can't, I'm saying if you believe in that, then I can understand where you're in it and where you reinterpret certain sayings or sentences or in a certain way, or you stand out of it and you say, I can't understand. It doesn't rhythm with what I either believe or the way an historian works, which is, you know, has a set of tools and he uses them to work in a certain way, and certain tools he cannot use because they're unapplicable to the situation. So he's, if you wish, stuck. So that's where I'm stuck. Last one?
Okay. Last one. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for keeping people later than they expected. You asked us to act as Israelis. Baruch Hashem, I am an Israeli. I live in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, and it's 4:20 in the morning for me now. So you'll have to excuse me if I possibly missed something that you said earlier.
It's also for me, it's 4:20.
So
we're in the same situation.
Okay. It's okay. But the rest of us are not.
Okay.
I'm originally from here, from this shul, B'nai Torah. You might have mentioned this, and I sort of, because it's so early in the morning for me, I dozed off maybe, and I didn't hear you. But there's an excellent book, which I think is very close to this topic, which I have to really commend you. I don't know if this is your chosen topic, or if the Torah in Motion suggested this topic, but it's a very difficult topic, I think, to discuss. And I think when I read this, it really interested me, and I was wondering what you could possibly say, because it's bordering on possibly Lashon Hara, if you're not very careful. None of us like to set ourselves up as judges. I certainly can appreciate Mr. Shapiro's position and the young man who spoke after him. So there's a sefer, which I imagine you're probably familiar with, and I don't know if you mentioned anything. I don't remember the name of the rabbi, but the book is called Eim HaBanim Smecha. It was a Rabbi Turkel, something like
Teichtel.
That? Teichtel.
Teichtel?
Okay, Teichtel, right. I excuse his family for mispronouncing his name. But it's 420, so I think he'll be Michael. But the Mechila part is very important. I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage for a person to stand up and admit that they made a mistake and ask for Mechila from those he possibly misled. I don't know, I could be wrong. I don't know too many Rabbanim from that period who stood up like Rabbi Teichel. And my recollection of the book, he wasn't only apologizing for himself, for his colleagues as well. It's a book that I highly recommend for anyone who's interested in this subject. Did you mention this book?
You're fine. You're awake. I did not.
No, this is how I perform when I'm asleep.
So if you're awake, when you're awake, it's...
I really want to commend you for the way you handled and juggled all the various competing issues and demands of this subject. And I want to thank you for coming here. I'm going to let Jay thank you officially, but just for myself. But I think the important point is that of all these things, and it's very difficult to look at what each one did and didn't do and why he did it, and maybe he was looking more at his personal interests and... I think that this sefer, I think, really hits the mark.
I thank you for your addition and the reference. It's absolutely in place. And I should have mentioned it.
It's in English as well for those.
Yeah, I know. I should have mentioned it, and I did not. But what I should say is that it is again in the spectrum of, I think, rabbis who, for instance, remain silent. Because they really were, part of that silence is that sense of, I have nothing to say because I missed out. I thank you and I accept your point, and I think it's a very valid point. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Excuse me, I have one, I'd like to have it clarified. You can help me with it. I visited Poland twice in the past 10 years.
Poland. He was in Poland twice.
And what really burns me up, and I'm sure all the people here will know about the situation. I read last year in the Jewish newspaper and also in the Polish papers and on radio where the Polish government is trying to get the Jews to come back to Poland, resettle. I visited Warsaw and all other cities. In Warsaw, in the synagogue, you can't get 10 people to have a minyan even. There is some Russian Jews and a few Israelis that are involved in businesses, in building contractors. However, this is the fifth session that I attended. And as you know, probably you've seen it, there's a Dr. Grabowski, and there's, I think, let me get the other name, and John Thomas, that was in the church, and he was, again, trying to sort of soften the issue about the Polish people, how they handled the Jews. And it was going on saying that the Jews lived in Poland 1,000 years and everything else. And I said, yes, that is all true. But the opportunity came and they all slaughtered and took our homes. And I says, furthermore, I have 3 homes there. Can I get them back? And he said, yes, of course you can. If you get, bring the papers. My God, papers. I came out of Poland without a shirt. There was no Jewish human being that ever had any papers after the war. Now.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I just want to thank Kimmy. Dr. Kaplan, really for a nuanced view of a very complex subject, and as you hear, raises emotions, and I thank you for the presentation. Dr. Kaplan will be at Or Chaim on Shabbat. Anybody who lives in the neighborhood will be speaking on why America never developed a chief rabbinate, the tragic failure of Rav Yaakov Yosef, and he'll also be speaking about immigrant rabbis who discover America. So if you live in the Or Chaim area like I do, you can come and join us, and I want to thank you all and have a Shabbat Shalom. Your program is coming up. Thank you.